in human history. We Christians are in a unique position these days in our country. We are still the religion of the majority of Americans, but the percentages are shrinking. More and more people are choosing to freely exercise a religion that is not ours, or to exercise no religion at all. That is their constitutional right, which as Americans we celebrate, but it does leave many within the Christian community feeling de-emphasized or disenfranchised or maybe even dissed a little bit. It's almost like when you coach your own kid's baseball team. In order to make it clear you're not favoring your own kid, you actually play him less than the other kids. And because we're the majority religion, sometimes it feels, to some of us anyway, that in order to be fair, we end up with fewer privileges than other faiths. I don't know if that's true, but sometimes it feels that way. Or that we presume that there should be no faith at all in order to make sure no one is overly exposed to any one particular faith. So we're not going to pray at a graduation because that presumes that everybody is a believer. We're not going to sing Christmas carols in school, even though we might sing a Hanukkah song for cultural enrichment. Now, being Presbyterians, we would almost certainly disagree about whether this is a terrible development or a healthy one. But either way, I think our questioner, today's questioner's supposition is true, that society is indeed increasingly secular in the sense that our public institutions are not going to be singing the church's song or sharing the gospel message for us. And the other reality that people of all faiths share is an increasingly vocal atheist movement that says not only is religion, and usually by that they mean Christian religion, but not only is religion false, but it's actually bad for you. I can't resist saying two things about that that really are other sermons. First is that, sad to say, some expressions of Christian faith I think probably are bad for you. And by that I mean the anti-intellectual ones and the incredibly judgmental ones that seek to shut people out rather than bring them in as Jesus did. And secondly, no atheist I've ever read or heard has yet answered, at least to my satisfaction, the question, why is there something instead of nothing? Why does anything at all exist? Fear not, I'm going to leave those questions for another day. But we live in a society that's increasingly indifferent and sometimes feels hostile to people who are trying to live by faith. The most obvious example is that Sunday mornings are no longer sacred. That's been true for a long time. 30 years ago in the church Kathy and I served as seminary interns in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, the Harrisburg Marathon was run on a Sunday morning, the first time, running through the city, right by the doors of the church we served, and our church leaders protested that street closings on Sunday morning would negatively impact church attendance, and the response from marathon organizers was, well, we're sorry, but the church will just need to compete in the great marketplace of ideas and causes just like everyone else. Something had clearly changed. And since then, it's not just marathons, it's soccer games and gymnastics meets and birthday parties sometimes that are freely scheduled for Sunday mornings. So sometimes we might feel a little bit like the Jews that were exiled to Babylon, who wrote this psalm during their time when they were far from home, in a place where they were enslaved by another nation, where they were surrounded by people who worshipped other gods. Hear the word of God. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down and there we wept when we remembered Zion. On the willows there we hung up our harps, for there our captors asked us for songs and our tormentors asked for mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How could we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? If I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand wither, let my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth, if I do not remember you, if I do not set Jerusalem above my highest joy. The word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? I'm not nearly suggesting that our situation in 21st century America is anything like the Jewish experience of being held captive in a foreign city. But the question, how do we sing the Lord's song in what seems more and more like an indifferent land, at least? That sounds like a good question in a society in which it's no longer necessary to be a member of a church to succeed in the business world, a society in which it's no longer expected that parents should give their children a good moral upbringing in church, some sort of religious grounding. A number of theologians in recent years have said the most appropriate image for the church today is exile. The most important question is, how do we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? And since we're in that situation, we might as well think, well, how might this be a good thing? Maybe it's a good thing because as people of faith, and as parents in particular, we have to choose what really matters to us. We have to intentionally decide what values, what beliefs we're going to transmit to the next generation, to our children. I mean, it's really not up to our country to restore the favored place to Christian faith. It's not constitutional after all, and our Constitution is an amazing document for all of us, even and especially, really, especially when it upholds the rights of the minorities of us. But it's really up to us as people of faith and parents to show why faith matters. That's a challenge we should take on with enthusiasm. Does faith make a difference in my life? If so, I should want to pass it on. Do I sense a source beyond my own self, a source of peace, courage, hope? If so, then I want my children to have that. Do people of faith make a difference in the world? You know, one of the very best advertisements of faith that I've ever seen is like the one that Dave Crandall described a minute ago. It was in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina in a Lowe's lumber store in D'Iberville, Mississippi, that was filled with church people from Seattle and Georgia and Connecticut and Illinois, and they were all in D'Iberville to rebuild homes after the hurricane for free. It's like I said, one of the best advertisements for being a person of faith ever. So how do we keep God in our kids' hearts in an increasingly secular society? Well, first of all, if you want your faith to mean something to your kids, then it needs to mean something to you. When confirmation class begins every year, we will sometimes, not that often, but sometimes we'll get an eighth grader who has rarely come to church, but his parents want him to get a little religion, you know, just a little, not too much for heaven's sakes, but just a little. And so they drop him off and they go to Denny's. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm thrilled to have that young man in class. I'm glad to have the chance to share a little faith with him. But the loudest message by far is being preached by the parents who are ordering a grand slam breakfast rather than coming to worship. If faith means something to you, then it will mean something to your kids. Maybe not right away, but it will. Even if your kids stray during their young adult years, they are paying attention. Some of you have seen the Stephen Sondheim musical Into the Woods, which is the fairy tale to end all fairy tales with practically every fairy tale character in it. But the witch in that story is singing about her daughter Rapunzel and what she's learned. And she says, "Careful the things you say, children will listen," she sings. "Careful the things you do, children will see and learn. Children may not obey, but children will listen. Children will look to you for which way to turn to learn what to be." If a Broadway musical knows that, then we Christian parents ought to know that too. John Westerhoff, Christian educator, said, you know, Christian faith isn't taught, it's caught. It's caught, and our children watch to see what's important to us. And what's important to us, they can't miss that message, no matter what they do with it in the short term. It's a message they deal with in the long term. It's a message they hear, because children will listen. What do you want your children to see and hear? Wow, we could go on this one. But today we celebrate the sacrament of the Lord's Supper. We will take simple bread and juice, and we will remember. We will remember Christ's love for each one of us and for all of us together. The Christian way is a sacramental approach to life. A sacramental approach to life. How you see your life matters as you learn to see God in all things. The story is told of the 5-year-old at his sister's crib, whispering to her, "Tell me again what God looks like. I'm beginning to forget." What does God look like? Well, I think it looks like all those people in the hardware store in Harrisburg, Illinois, who were there giving up a week's vacation solely to help someone put their life back together. One of you told me this week you'd received help from God moving into your new home because several people had been there to do the actual lifting. I heard at a wedding recently that love is just the greatest thing, isn't it? As the person named God's greatest gift. I heard another person describe their work at Abbott Laboratories as being a small part of God's healing work in the world. Not always interesting, not always exciting, but a small part of God's healing work in the world. That's a sacramental approach to life. When you look for God, it's amazing how often God shows up. And if you do it, your kids will learn to do it too. You want your kids to keep God in their hearts? Well, seek the fellowship of the church. A man once scoffed at the church, telling William Sloan Coffin, the pastor of the church he only rarely attended, that the church was really just a crutch for the weak. To which Coffin replied, "What makes you think you don't limp?" It takes a village to raise a child, and the truth is we're all children who at one time or another need one another. I do think, however, that we, your church, needs to have a conversation about how we can help make that happen. I mean, there's so much competition for Sunday mornings now, and part of that solution might be parents making church a priority over other activities. I wonder if a lot of parents stood up and said, "We really don't need to have soccer practice on Sunday morning." Would that change? I know 10 years ago it made a difference when our daughter was playing travel soccer. They tried to schedule around church as much as they could. But I know, that is an uphill battle. It's a given that the world has changed. So how do we make it possible for families to be part of the life of the church when Sunday morning isn't always going to work? I'm interested in hearing what you think, and I'll be at the coffee hour after worship. There's a lot more to say, but I leave you this morning with this from Marilynne Robinson's novel Gilead that won the Pulitzer Prize in 2005. John Ames is the narrator. He's the pastor of a small church in Gilead, Iowa. Ames married late in life and has a 7-year-old son. He's now 77 years old. He knows his own death is near, and the novel is his letter to his son, telling him things that he knows that he won't be around to say later. Ames tells of preparing to preach a sermon on the story of Hagar and Ishmael. You remember the story. Hagar is the slave woman with whom Abraham has had a son, Ishmael, and because of Abraham's wife Sarah's jealousy, Abraham sadly sends Hagar and Ishmael out into the desert. When they run out of water and are near death, then the angel of the Lord calls out to Hagar and Ishmael and leads them to a pool of water and to life. And Ames remembers this story and his own young son, who he knows will soon be fatherless, and he writes this: "That is how life goes. We send our children into the wilderness. Some of them on the day they're born, it seems, for all the help we can give them. Some of them seem to be a kind of wilderness unto themselves. But there must be angels there too, and springs of water. even that wilderness is the Lord's. I need to bear this in mind. It most certainly is a wilderness of a world out there into which we send our children. But it's the Lord's wilderness. And the promise of our baptism is that there's never a place so wild or so far away that our children will not find pools of living water, will not be able to hear the voices of angels, will not be able to know the unfathomable grace of God. So when you send your children out into the world, bear that in mind. Pray with me. O Lord, bless each of us as we not only mold and shape young lives, but as we seek to sing your song in this place. For Christ's sake, for the world's sake, and our own sakes, we ask it, and for our children's sake. And let all God's people say, Amen.